This is Stateside for Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today, we talk to a business leader who wants legal protections for LGBTQ people and a gay politician who says those legal protections are not needed.
We've also seen the private sector react in the past to change discriminatory policies when they've existed.
The first national park was Yellowstone. The next was in Michigan.
Mackinac National Park was the second park in the United States dating to 1875.
We'll hear how it later became a state park. An updated system for driverless cars is being tested on the streets of Detroit. Are people ready for them?
People are going to get into self-driving cars when they have confidence that the car is going to do the job well.
And we've got a cheers cocktail for you.
This is a twist on a classic cocktail called the Bee's Knees, but we're going to add some beer to it and make it a beer's knees.
Plus funding for the Michigan Indian Tuition Waiver. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In Michigan, you can be fired because you're gay. You can be denied housing in some instances. You can be denied service at a restaurant or a bar because you're gay. That might be changing. There's a bill in the legislature that would extend protections for LGBTQ folks under what's known as the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a Republican who is gay and who thinks LGBTQ community doesn't need to be protected by the state in this way. But first, joining us now is a West Michigan business leader who thinks protection under the law is necessary and important. Andy Owen is the CEO of Herman Miller. Welcome.
Hi, Lester.
So why are you urging Michigan legislators to add sexual orientation, sexual identity to the protections of the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act?
You know, I've worked in a creative industry for my entire career. Before I came to Herman Miller, I was in the fashion industry, and I have been surrounded by diverse thinkers, innovators, creative people. And I think the way that we need to win as businesses in today's world is by being inclusive, by adding as many differences, diverse opinions as we can to our workforce. So for me, it's a talent and retention and business imperative, as well as the right thing to do.
Well, nobody's stopping you from hiring people who are within the LGBTQ community. So why do they need protection under the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act?
You know, it's a great question. And when I came to Michigan, I have to admit that I didn't realize that our LGBTQ community did not have these basic protections until I was interviewing a candidate. And that candidate had done their homework and came with questions about the company, but also questions about the state, and asked me about protections for discrimination against the LGBTQ community. And when I got out of that conversation, I did my homework. And for me, it is one of those things that when you are coming to our state in order to be competitive as an LGBTQ person, you need to feel safe. You need to feel that your employment will never be taken away from you because of who you are and who you love. You'll be able to eat where you want. You'll be able to have a house where you want. So for me, as I try to attract people to my company, sure, I can have protections within my company that guarantee that. And we have for centuries had protections against anti-discrimination at Herman Miller. However, I can't guarantee that once that employee that comes to work at Herman Miller leaves, they have the same protections outside of the workplace. And that's why it's very important.
So this person that you interviewed, what was their major concern? Were they from Michigan? Did they know about it? Or were they from out of state?
You know, actually, Lester, I've interviewed quite a few people from out of state and from both coasts. And this person happened to be from New York. And their concern was that they were coming from a state where these protections were guaranteed. And they were concerned as a member of the LGBT community that coming to Michigan, they might encounter situations where they were not protected. And so that was the basis of their question.
I think a lot of people believe that since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that same-sex marriage was legal, that everything for LGBTQ folks is okay. You're saying that's not the case. So why do you think that Elliot Larson will solve that?
I think it'll solve that because I think most people don't realize that these basic protections around employment, around housing, around where you eat, that people that are in the LGBT community can be denied these basic rights that many of us have. So, yes, we have the right to marry, but what if I want to rent a house and you don't want to rent it to me because I'm gay? So I think the expansion of this act and extending these protections so that Michigan can become inclusive versus exclusive is critical.
With this recent news of the Attorney General advising the Michigan Civil Rights Commission that it can investigate complaints of discrimination against LGBTQ people, why is that not enough? Doesn't it accomplish the same thing as expanding the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act?
You know, I don't think it does. I mean, I think you need to have the ability to take action and the ability to take this to court, the ability to defend yourself and protect yourself.
What's at stake for Michigan if the legislature does not add protections for LGBTQ people?
I think what's at stake for us is the most diverse and competitive and innovative workforce. In today's world, where things are changing at a pace that is more rapid than any of us could have ever imagined, we need a workforce that is innovative, that is creative, that can solve problems that are coming at us at 1,000 miles an hour. And I think if we do not open our state to every single kind of person, if we are not inclusive, we will not be competitive and we won't have a talent we need to move forward.
Andy Owen is the CEO of Herman Miller. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Lester. It was a pleasure.
Let's now turn to an opponent of expanding Elliot Larson protections to LGBTQ folks. Leon Drolette is a Republican Macomb County Commissioner, a former state representative. And for the purposes of this conversation, Leon, I guess we should add that you are a gay man. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay. So why do you think it's unnecessary to expand Elliot Larson?
Well, I think a lot of the things that Andy talked about are not real concerns of many LGBT folks in the real world. For example, I can't think of an incident in Michigan, certainly in years, where somebody's been denied being able to eat in a restaurant or denied buying a home or something because of their sexual
orientation. Actually, I'm going to interrupt you there because I know some folks at the Fair Housing Coalitions around the state, and they would certainly disagree with that.
I'm not saying there's not instances. I don't know of any. And I don't think it's on the mind of the other gay folks that I talk to that, gee, I'm going to apply for a mortgage or I'm going to rent an apartment or I'm going to go stop at this restaurant, that they are going to be discriminated against based on their sexual orientation. You know, incidences can occur. Individual instances can absolutely occur. And they occur for some people. They don't think their political orientation. The incidences can happen. But it's not a widespread concern. I frankly think it's incredibly rare that somebody would say, gee, I want to move to Michigan, but I'm afraid that I won't be able to serve at a restaurant. Because it, for the most part, doesn't happen.
Have you faced discrimination? I know one of your political campaigns got pretty wild because some people were making accusations that you were in favor of allowing, you know, public gay sex or some ridiculous thing like that. So you've seen this yourself.
In several of my political campaigns, I have had, the American Family Association of Michigan do robocalls saying I have an extremist, gay agenda, or an opponent in one case who later apologized and printed a retraction, accusing me of, advocating for public sex and all kinds of, crazy allegations. And, those have been overcome. I certainly have faced that in the political sphere. I've never faced discrimination in going to a restaurant or nothing in regard to discrimination in the traditional sense of, being told I couldn't rent a home or something. We focus on this law that changed or this politician that did this or that. And while those things can be important, and there certainly have been laws that, have made a major impact, more impact has been made by the individuals, private individuals coming out to their families, their friends, their coworkers, overcoming those obstacles, the conversations that folks have, those are what really change the world. Changing a law is like a trophy. It's something you can put up on a wall and point to, but it really isn't the hard work that is done to make change.
Well, if that's the case, why have any civil rights laws at all? Why include anything in the Constitution or the state Constitution to protect any class of people?
Well, I think that when it comes to government, the government certainly should treat all citizens equally and neutrally. And here in Michigan, we've adopted a constitutional amendment that says the government shall not discriminate against nor grant preferential treatment to any person on the basis of race, gender, national origin, ethnicity, that sort of thing. And I would be completely in favor of the Michigan Constitution being amended to state that to include sexual orientation. That applies then to all government entities. But when it comes to private institutions, such as, you know, a restaurant or a club or whatever it might be, you know, we've seen where most private institutions have already adopted non-discrimination policies. Almost every Fortune 500 company has adopted such provisions. And we've also seen the private sector react in the past to change discriminatory policies when they've existed. But I think that's how it really is best handled.
Well, what I hear you saying, though, is government should step out of the way. Government should allow a little bit of discrimination, and the marketplace or the private sector will work it out.
I think the government should respect minority views. And minority views can include very unpopular views in the private sphere. So if somebody has a very ugly view that they don't want to serve people who are gay at their restaurant, or they don't want to hire someone who's gay and it's a private entity, I think it's best worked out in the social sphere. I mean, for one, I would not want to eat at a restaurant that had an ugly policy like that. I'd rather it in some ways be explicit than be hidden and manifest itself in other ways. Similarly, if I was working in a company that where the people who ran the company had a very negative and hostile view about people who are gay, heck, I'd like to know about it, and I'll look for another job.
Let me give you a little exaggerated scenario. So if people start posting gays need not apply for the job, or that LGBTQ folks are not allowed in, I mean, how is that different than the racial stuff we saw in the 1950s?
Well, I think the difference is the widespread and the prominence of the discrimination. In the 1950s, in many cases, that discrimination was ensconced in Jim Crow laws and in other laws. But beyond that, it was pervasive. There is many other options today because society is much more open. I can go find another baker to bake me a cake. I can go find another restaurant to eat in.
So let me ask you one final question. What would be the harm in expanding the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act to protect LGBTQ folks?
I don't think there'd be very much harm. There may be some discrimination that occurs against folks who really do have, you know, strongly held religious views, but I honestly don't think it would make that much of a difference.
Leon Drolet is a Republican Macomb County Commissioner and a former state representative. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Coming up this week, driverless Ford cars hit the streets of Detroit. We'll talk with the engineer who helped design the technology to make it happen. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the Michigan State Park System. Some of the oldest parks are up by the Straits of Mackinac, and here to tell us about that is Dominic Miller. He's marketing manager of the Mackinac State Historic Park System. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I understand that two of your three parks actually were around before we even had a state park system. Let's talk about Mackinac Island State Park. What kind of park was it originally?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So Mackinac State Park dates to 1895, but it actually dates prior to that. Mackinac National Park was the second park in the United States dating to 1875. So it actually predates Michigan State Park for 20 years and became Mackinac State Park in 1895.
Wow, I didn't know it was a national park. That's interesting. So when and why did the state of Michigan take possession of the Mackinac Island State Park, or the park?
Yeah, absolutely. There was no, national park commission, or there was no thing to govern the national parks in the late 1800s. So the War Department was running both the national park and an active military installation on Mackinac Island. And after a while, they didn't want to be doing either of those things in that area. So they abandoned the fort. They moved the soldiers elsewhere. But the state of Michigan stepped in, and you know, instead of just selling off the parcels of the national park, they transferred the national park lands over to the state of Michigan with the caveat that if the state didn't want it anymore, it would revert back to being a national park. The state has kept it ever since. The State Park Commission was created then, and it's been a state park ever since, and will continue to be so for as long as we can imagine, at least.
So for those folks who haven't been to Mackinac Island, what's there? What's at the Mackinac Island State Park?
Well, absolutely. About 82% of Mackinac Island is state park land. And there are just beautiful natural wonders and curiosities there, such as Arch Rock and Sugarloaf Rock. And then there's the historic element of McLennan State Park, which, of course, the centerpiece being Fort Mackinac, an authentic Revolutionary War-era fort. And then there's 70 miles plus of hiking and biking and horse riding trails and, you know, just these beautiful views and vistas. And so just, you know, so much to kind of see and explore in your time on Mackinac Island.
Now, the other older park is in Mackinac City. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that Michigan's second state park is in Mackinac City, and that's Michilimackinac State Park. It's right at the base of the Mackinac Bridge cuts right through, but two historic sites fall within Michilimackinac State Park as well, and that's Colonial Michilimackinac, which was built as a French fort and palisade wall in 1715, and then Old Mackinac Point Lighthouse, which was built in 1892, fall within that state park. And it's always been kind of platted as a park. So when the French built this structure in 1715, the British later took it over in the 1760s, and they moved this fort and village over to Mackinac Island. That's what became Fort Mackinac and the village of Mackinac Island. But this was always preserved as a parkland. This was the old fort area. So when the village was platted, and even when the village became a village, this was always set aside, and it became a city park, and then later transferred to the Mackinac Island State Park Commission in 1909 and became Michigan's second state park.
And you've got a reproduction there now, right?
Absolutely. Colonial Michilimackinac has 13 reconstructed buildings. It's a British fort. We date to the 1770s inside here. We do live demonstrations. We fire the cannon. We fire the muskets. We're cooking. We have 5,500 square feet of gardens inside. A lot to explore inside Colonial Michilimackinac.
I want to get back to Mackinac Island really quickly, but I want to ask you about your third park that you manage. It came along a lot more recently. Tell us about Mill Creek State Park.
Yeah, historic Mill Creek Discovery Park and Mill Creek State Park, where it's a water-powered sawmill, and there was one there historically, and that was kind of the glue between Fort Michilimackinac and Fort Mackinac. And we've reconstructed that sawmill today. It was rediscovered in the 70s, became a state park in the 1980s. And now it's a natural preserve out there. There's more than 600 acres for people to explore, and it's a lot of natural history out there to go along with the historical elements of the saw pit and the sawmill, and you can kind of see how kind of a frontier, you know, area was built in the 1800s.
You've got our first two big industries covered there, fur trade and lumber.
Absolutely.
You know, Mackinac
absolutely.
Island was really important to Native American tribes before Europeans showed up. Then the French established a mission, and it was the center of this massive fur trade in the Great Lakes region. The British came. What period does Mackinac State Historic Park system present to visitors today on the island?
Oh, on the island, we're a little later in the period. We're during the National Park Days. It's the 1880s when you come inside Fort Mackinac, and which is kind of a unique window into our past. It's kind of a maybe even overlooked era a little bit, but it's unique because it's an active military installation, but they're also caretakers for the national park. So we get to present kind of these two dynamics to visitors to Fort Mackinac today.
I'm told you get to live on Mackinac Island during the summer. What's that like?
It is spectacular. I can't phrase it in another way. You know, I have to pinch myself a lot when I get up and I look outside and I see, you know, the blue waters of Lake Huron looking down. It's unique. I have two small children, so it's a unique way. It can be challenging. You know, you go grocery shopping. It's not as easy as just getting in the car and heading down to Meijer or anything.
Yeah, there is no car.
But yeah. That's right. But it's a challenge that I wouldn't trade for anything in the world. It's truly amazing to be able to call Mackinac Island home.
All right, well, let me put you on the spot. What is the single must-see item of the three parks?
Oh, my goodness. I'm biased. I live on Mackinac Island. My office is right next to the cannon platform. You got to come to Fort Mackinac, and you got to see them fire the iconic Fort Mackinac cannon. The view is amazing. You're getting to kind of see how it was done historically. That's the one thing I wouldn't miss.
Well, congratulations to the entire Michigan State Park System on its 100th anniversary, and it's nice to talk about the first two oldest parks in Michigan. Dominic Miller is marketing manager of the Mackinac State Historic Parks. Thanks for telling us about your parks, and now I'm going to turn you back to whatever you were doing in beautiful Mackinac Island. I'll go back. I'll be here at the radio station grinding away, okay?
Somebody has to do it, so I'll take that bullet, I guess, today.
All right. Thanks much, Dominic.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
The company working with Ford to develop fleets of driverless cars is now testing its systems on the streets of Detroit. Joining us now to talk about this third generation of driverless cars is the president of Argo AI, Peter Rander. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So you've already been testing driverless cars in places like Pittsburgh, Washington, D.C., Miami. What challenges will Detroit offer that you've not faced in these other cities?
So Detroit heads us into the Motor City with roads that are normally extremely laid out, nice, wide, and you get into that wonderful downtown core and those transitions of going from kind of a really old school city with that core of roads that aren't on that nice, perfect grid that change quickly on you and give you a wonderful, vibrant activity with a city that's really coming back to life with construction and everything else. And that's just a wonderful, wonderful environment for us to have real world life for self-driving cars to learn to do better.
Well, construction's one thing that would be difficult in itself, but I read you'll be testing these driverless cars in the Campus Martius area. That area is erratic traffic patterns, a large number of pedestrians. Have your driverless cars faced a scenario like that before?
Similar scenarios to that, but each area has a unique culture. The typical patterns in Washington, D.C. are different from Miami and are different in Detroit for what the locals consider acceptable. What's the social norms? Where do you cross? How long do you wait? You know, what are pedestrians expecting versus the cars? Those things are all very local and extremely important that we get into there. It's also where people don't really, they're not all that thrilled about driving. And that's part of why we're there. We think self-driving will help meet a customer need that people would just as soon not have to go through that driving experience themselves.
As I mentioned in the intro, this is the third generation of your technology. What's improved about this latest system?
This has better sensing, better compute, and what's called a fail functional technology in the base car that Ford itself been working on.
Let's break those all down because, you know, you're talking about radar, higher resolution cameras, backup systems. Tell us about each one of those and why that matters.
You bet. So better radar and cameras help the system to see better, to see further away, to see through better, broader range of lighting conditions and weather conditions. Better compute needs to match that better sensing because now with higher resolution, you now need to process more data to make sure that you're processing everything and able to do that. And then better backup systems as a step toward what we ultimately need is something with the full reliability and fault tolerance so that when something breaks, not if, everything will eventually have a break, that the system is able to be aware, detect it, respond, and take a safe corrective action.
And right now you have another contingency. You actually have people in the car.
Absolutely. Right now, as we've talked about very publicly, we're in a development phase and still have a couple of years yet before we anticipate launching. So the driver pair, there's a driver and a what we call a driver and a co-driver who are there to absolutely monitor that system with significant training to make sure that while we're there and sharing that public road space, that we're acting responsibly to make sure that as far as anyone else is concerned, it may look different, but you can count on the normal safety and reliability you're expecting from any well-behaved driver on the roads.
You're testing your system out now on a Ford Fusion Hybrid. What other vehicles have you tested it in, and does the kind of car or vehicle matter?
So we've only tested Fusions so far. Others will be coming in the future. Does the kind of car matter? Yeah, the car matters in several different ways. One, if you think about what a lot of people have experienced, when you move from a car to a crossover or an SUV or a truck, your lines of sight change, your visibility around the vehicle and your comfort there and having the confidence to be able to drive safely all needs to be trained. And if it's your first time in one of those, it's like, I'm a little unsure. The driving dynamics also change. The way the body, you know, weight transfers when if you have to do a sudden maneuver because somebody else was maybe not following quite the right rules, changes the dynamics. And of course, the acceleration and braking in particular. You know, when you get into a vehicle with high power engine, you can go very quickly. Quite different if you're in a vehicle that has less power, it takes longer to accelerate. And you need to think about that when you're trying to enter traffic, when you're supposed to be yielding the right of way or entering the flow of traffic.
From some of the photos that Argo AI posted, I see that the unit, the apparatus on top of the car, is pretty large. Is that eventually going to be scaled down to something a little less, I won't say obtrusive, it's prominent, let's put it that way.
it is prominent, and we're really focusing on a system that works safely and confidently, and over time, absolutely, we'll all be working to reduce that size. The studio teams would dearly love to get something smaller. So as you take the long view, absolutely, this gets better and better integrated, less and less obtrusive. But right now, that's not the number one priority. Style doesn't dominate here. People are going to get into self-driving cars when they have confidence that the car is going to do the job well. And right now, that is the focus of making sure the system works well, works reliably, works safely to build that customer confidence that this is a service that they'd want to use.
I was told you went to college in Detroit, and news of tech being introduced into cars inspired you to pursue this idea of autonomous vehicles. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You bet. I went to school at University of Detroit, now University of Detroit Mercy. I entered when it was U of D, and I graduated from UDM. And I did a co-op. UDM has a co-op program where students are expected to go through at least three phases of working with companies to develop very practical hands-on experience to apply the classroom lessons that they've been learning. And I got a chance to work in the auto industry and doing that and seeing a little window as you do as a co-op. You're not going to learn the whole process, but seeing different parts of how big companies run and assemble cars and realizing how hard it is to get technology through that pipeline because of the rigor that needs to go in there and the scale. And realizing that there were still so many opportunities. It was neat to see what was there, but realizing, wow, there's so much more coming. And that eventually sent me off to grad school to try to pursue the future technologies that could help.
Your partner, Ford, would like to start selling driverless cars in 2021 to certain fleet buyers. How close are you to a production model?
So we are on pace right now. We're cruising along at doing that. For us, the dominant part of the schedule is to focus on making sure it works well, not strict adherence to any particular deadline. Those are all laid in, but its system has to work, and that progress has been very good.
Okay, for the curious, there are people who are going to be wondering, wow, will I see one of these on the streets of Detroit? How will we be able to tell if that Ford Fusion Hybrid is one of your test vehicles?
So they are all, the Ford Fusion Hybrids are all marked with Argo and Ford on the side. Says the car is self-driving, a web address to contact us if there's any feedback people would like to give. So pretty easy to spot these vehicles.
Prominent, it sounds like.
Yes.
What's next for Argo AI and Ford?
So we're working steadily at expanding and refining the prototypes. There'll be more prototypes as we work our way to get to production. We're trying to expand the city footprint so that we continue to learn more and more about not just one location, but a set of locations and learning those patterns, which helps make the system better and better. So service launch is rapidly approaching.
Peter Rander is the president of Argo AI. Thanks for telling us the latest on your driverless car system.
Wonderful. Thank you. Appreciate being on.
This week, Guinness World Records recognized the Manistee Fire Department as the longest-running fire station in the world. Engineer paramedic Fred LaPointe spearheaded the effort.
It would be bringing recognition not just to our firefighters, but to firefighters everywhere throughout the world. And if there was other people that were interested in challenging the category, it would be something that other departments could venture into if they felt like it.
The Manistee Fire Department has been operating since 1869.
Cheers.
Cheers. Bon vivant. Cheers.
I'm Lester Graham with Stateside, and it's time for another episode of Cheers to Michigan. Here with me is Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tasting.
Hi, Lester.
You're building a little summery drink here.
I am. So this is a twist on a classic cocktail called the Bee's Knees, but we're going to add some beer to it and make it a beer's knees.
Okay. I've heard of Bee's Knees before, but I don't remember exactly what it was.
So this is a drink that was invented during Prohibition. It used gin, lemon juice, and then honey syrup. They used honey syrup instead of a regular simple syrup because the honey would help cover up the bad taste of the gin during Prohibition. But with good honey and good gin, it's actually a really nice combination. So that's the Bee's Knees. And to make it a beer's knees, we're going to add a little hoppy IPA that's going to kind of mash that Bee's Knees up with a summer shandy.
Now, this IPA, M43, I've heard of it, very popular.
Yes, it's definitely a crowd pleaser around here. This is one of those Northeast style hazy IPAs, so super citrusy, really fresh and bright, almost drinks like a shandy on its own because it has all that citrus in the can.
This gin, though, I don't know it.
So this is from Wiseman Distillery, and they are actually Michigan's newest distillery. They just opened up at the end of May, and in the interest of full disclosure, I did do some work with them developing their opening cocktail menu. But they're doing some really interesting products, and this is their gin, which is a kind of classic London dry style, juniper, and then a lot of citrus in there as well.
Well, with all that citrus going on, plus some lemon juice, it should be interesting to see how this tastes, which I think I'll do that now, okay?
Sounds good.
Really nice. Didn't make me pucker up like I thought it might because of all the citrus. Well balanced. And there's a nice little honey aftertaste. That's really pleasant.
And easy to drink sitting out on your back porch, maybe after lawn mowing.
Definitely do the mowing before you do the drinking.
That is a very good piece of advice, Lester.
Well, cheers.
Cheers.
Still to come, public colleges and universities are required to offer tuition waivers to qualified students from tribal communities. Yet for the last two decades, the state has been shortchanging schools on reimbursements.
Right up until 1995, the state of Michigan, in a bipartisan way, was supporting the Michigan Indian tuition waiver. Governor John Engler in 1995 used it as a political chess piece.
For the first time in nearly 20 years, the state is fully funding tuition waivers for Native American colleges and college students, at least for this year. More on that after the break.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Back in the mid-1970s, Michigan legislative leaders concluded that because of promises made to Native Americans of free education in exchange for land, the state needed to waive college tuition for tribal students. And it did for a long time. Then, at one point, Governor Engler vetoed the money for the Native American tuition waiver. The legislature started to bake the money into the general fund that goes to public universities, until it didn't. A House Fiscal Agency report says Michigan's public universities have been abiding by the law, but the state government has failed to reimburse the schools for more than $70 million since the year 2000. Joining us now is Representative Scott Van Singel, the Republican chair of the House Appropriations Subcommittee, to help us understand this issue better. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've proposed $4.2 million for reimbursement, reimbursing schools for tribal student waivers for last year. Why that amount?
Well, I was going to start chipping away at it. This is my first year as chair of the Higher Ed Committee. And then after seeing what the Senate did and hearing input from my committee members on both sides of the aisle, we decided to go ahead and fully fund that. And we did that as an amendment in committee. And for the first time, I believe, in decades, this program will be fully funded.
So the 4.2 actually makes up for a certain amount you already gave last year. Is that what I'm understanding?
We had put about $1.3 million in the preliminary budget, and then we did an amendment on top of that and fully funded it. So it's close to, I think it was $6.7 million or just under $7 million total that was the unfunded mandate on the universities.
Now, Michigan picked up this cost because the federal government passed on the responsibilities for meeting treaty obligations to the states. Does Michigan have a treaty obligation to waive tuition, or is this just a moral obligation the state has taken on?
It's actually in state law, from my understanding, and I believe the state law is based on treaties, but the universities don't have an option unless they have to, by law, provide this tuition. And because they're funded by the state universities, the assumption was that the state would reimburse them. And then about 20 years ago, we stopped fully reimbursing them. And it's grown to about almost $7 million a year, that unreimbursed tuition amount.
Right. Like I mentioned earlier, since the year 2000, more than $70 million in shortfalls in reimbursement for Michigan Indian tuition waivers. So why did we start seeing these shortfalls in reimbursements? What happened?
Part of it was tuition has been growing, and we had sort of put a fixed amount in years ago. And so as tuition grew and the original amount we put in had not. It just became a growing unfunded mandate. And what's really happened is it disproportionately affected some of the smaller schools. So Central Michigan University, they have the largest population, Lake Superior State, Northern Michigan, some of those small regional schools that are near Indian reservations have fairly substantial populations, and it's become quite a burden on some of those smaller schools.
Are you going to look at trying to pay the cost of the tuition waivers from previous years, that trying to cut into that $70 million that they feel is owed to them?
I really don't have the funds to do that. It would be nice if we did, but I was given about $14 million in new money to work with in the higher ed budget this year. And some of that went to operation grants. And then, like I said, about the $7 million went into the Indian Tuition Waiver Program. So the funds just aren't there. The way we did this money will now be built into their base for next year. So it should be permanently funded going forward. And we'll make small adjustments based on enrollment going forward. But long answer to a short question, no, we just don't have $70 million available in the budget to do that at this time.
The public universities are not the only ones who've have failed to get fully reimbursed, although it's a lot less money. Community colleges are also owed something like $750,000. What can or should be done about that?
Probably going to be the same thing. The Senate put that around $700,000 in their budget. We didn't do that on the House side, but the process isn't done. We're going to conference committee soon, and that very well could be added in on the community college side as well.
Representative Scott Van Singel, the chair of the House Appropriations Subcommittee, thanks very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks. Anytime.
This week, we heard from someone who benefited from the Michigan Indian Tuition Waiver about what it did for him.
My name is Banishi Kadro, or Joe Kadro. I am from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and a member of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. It took off a financial burden, which, once one looks at through a lens of systematic oppression, it enabled me to not only compete with non-Native students, but also gave me a chance at creating some equity within the academic realm.
Let's turn now to the president of the Michigan Indian Education Council and Northern Michigan University professor at the Center for Native American Studies, Martin Reinhardt. Welcome to the program.
Bonjour. Hello. Glad to be here.
So how important is this Michigan Indian tuition waiver to Native Americans in the state?
Well, it's very important. You know, the Michigan Indian tuition waiver has a very deep history in the relationship between Native people and non-Native people, and of course, they are educational institutions.
What has this meant to Native American communities?
Well, if you go back in history, what you'll see is that we had our own systems of education in place prior to colonization. And through the process of colonization, we entered into a number of treaties with non-Native people and their governments. And so the Michigan Indian Tuition Waiver at its roots is really based on treaty rights between the Anishinaabe, Three Fires Confederacy of Chippewa, Ottawa, and Potawatomi, and the United States of America.
I got to ask you the race-loaded question, and that's because a lot of people will say, why should Native American people get this unfair race-based benefit from the state? What would you say to them?
I would say that they're misinformed about the origins and the nature of the Michigan Indian Tuition Waiver. It's really based on treaties, which is legal and political, not race. It's kind of like the relationship between two countries. That's what a treaty is. It's an agreement between two sovereign entities.
How difficult is it for tribal members to get one of these tuition waivers?
Well, they have to be a citizen of a federally recognized tribe in the United States. They also have to be residents of Michigan for 12 months or more, and they have to be accepted into a Michigan public college or university.
Let's talk about the actual waiver law, the reimbursement for the waivers not being met by the state. We're seeing a big problems for the colleges that are near reservations, such as Central Michigan University, I assume Northern Michigan University as well. This Michigan Indian tuition waiver is law, but with the state government not reimbursing public colleges and universities for the cost of waivers, what do you think the future is for these waivers?
Well, you're right. It is the law. It's Public Act 174 of 1976 that says that Michigan public colleges and universities shall waive tuition for eligible Native students within the state. And right up until 1995, the state of Michigan, in a bipartisan way, was supporting the Michigan Indian tuition waiver. Governor John Engler in 1995 used it as a political chess piece to essentially try to say that he was cleaning up the state budget, and he made it a partisan issue. You know, fortunately, the legislature rolled it into the base budgets of colleges and universities, where it has been since. Unfortunately, it caused some commotion, and they also capped it at that level, and so they've had to now periodically reimburse the colleges and universities for the money that the state is in arrears as far as the reimbursement of the program. You know, that, of course, means that the colleges and universities that have the most Native students who are tuition waiver eligible are feeling the brunt of the reimbursement shortfalls.
Right. Collectively, they're $70 million behind in payments to the public universities since 2000. How concerned are you about that?
Well, you know, it's a shell wave again. And so where the colleges and universities are doing what they're supposed to be doing, the state of Michigan has to step up and do what it's supposed to be doing. You know, the state of Michigan inherited this responsibility when they entered into the Comstock Agreement of 1934, where they said, the governor of Michigan agreed that they would educate students, the Native students resident within the state of Michigan, at no further cost to the federal government, which means that they inherited that treaty obligation. Now, since 1934, the state of Michigan really has not stepped up to the plate and done what it's supposed to. The Michigan Indian Tuition Waiver was part of that obligation, and they have failed to even pay for the tuition waiver cost to the fullest extent.
At this point, the universities are bearing a lot of that cost, not all of it. There have been partial payments, and we're seeing a reimbursement for last year. What do you think should be done in the long run to ensure that the colleges and universities aren't bearing the full brunt of the tuition waiver?
Well, I think it's important to put it into perspective. This is not money out of the pockets of the universities and the colleges. This is just money that they're not currently getting from a state program that they're supposed to be getting if they did what they were supposed to do. That makes a big difference. They're still getting money from the students coming there because the students are counted as part of the general population. They're also getting the fees, the services, the dorm room costs, the books, the meals, the living expenses. I mean, they're getting certainly benefit from the Native students that are tuition waiver eligible being on their campus. And so that's important to put into perspective. But I think it's also important for our leadership to work together. The college and university leadership, the tribal leadership, they have to get together and say to the state and to the feds as well, you know, that this is important to our state. This is important for these students to be here, that they are part of our bright future. You know, we're trying to address things like global warming. And, you know, what if one of these students is the one that comes up with the answers? You know, do we want to let them languish on the sidelines because they couldn't afford to go to college or university? I don't think so.
Martin Reinhart is the president of the Michigan Indian Education Council and professor at Northern Michigan University's Center for Native American Studies. Thanks for taking the time to explain this.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, and it's been a pleasure.
The Michigan legislature is working on the state's budget. The House of Representatives passed its version last week. Here to talk about that are our Friday political commentators. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic state representative. And Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader of the Michigan Senate. Vicki, let's start with you. What you saw in the House budget, anything you really liked?
I liked its intention to really address fixing Michigan roads. It's just that the product that came out of that intention I find very problematic. It slashes transportation budgets. It slashes especially information technology, which is really going to hurt the ability of the state to address our massive technology issues. So, and I'm not even talking about the school aid budget and everything else.
Yeah, let's talk about the mechanism just for a second. They're basically saying, hey, that sales tax on gasoline, on that per dollar on gasoline, some of that goes other places. We want all of it to go to the roads, and that's going to shortchange some other places. Ken, what did you see that you liked in the House budget?
Well, Lester, I'm going to kind of describe it as a combination of the good and the bad and the ugly.
okay, what's the good?
Well, I think the good is sort of what Vicky pointed out, and that is, it's really all about road funding, and so that's good. It's bad in the sense they don't really find new revenue at this point. They're just shifting money around, which implies cuts in other areas, and I think there's some sort of ugly things in it, like, well, let's take a look at Sully the Blue Water Bridge. That's just sort of bizarre. But this is just a positioning budget. It's about starting the conversation, as is the phrase the House Republicans have used. I think they're right about that. I don't really think anybody's taking all of this quite seriously at this point.
Yeah, I just want to clarify one thing about a part of that solution of the sales tax all going to the roads. That would raise approximately $846 million a year for the roads. And the governor and other state officials are saying we need $2.2 billion a year for the roads. So we're not quite getting there. Vicky, let's talk about what was in the House budget that raised red flags for you.
Well, the shift in the sales tax on gasoline taxes and the attempt to, in a good economy, try to just shift money around without really addressing the fundamental issues of a budget that has not grown in two decades. When people approved Proposal A and we had the increase in the sales tax of 2 cents on a dollar, that money goes to local governments and schools. And when you shift the taxes on gasoline, you're also shifting that money that goes to local governments and schools. And that money was supposed to be constitutionally protected for local revenue sharing and for public education. You're now going to blow an $800 million, actually it's over $800 million whole in revenue sharing and public education dollars that the legislature says they will legislatively protect by backfilling it out of the general fund. Well, there's no guarantee that the next legislature won't end that. They're again putting local governments and public education in the spotlight as being terribly and woefully underfunded, which it already is now. So that's the big hole. That's the big problem. And Ken is right. This is just a game of shift and shaft, because you're cutting IT, you're cutting rides for seniors, you're cutting transportation dollars in all communities around the state, and you're underfunding the Department of Corrections, who has already raised red flags. And then the new legislators are looking at old solutions that we've already tried that don't work, like toll roads. So I don't really see an option here other than hopefully the Senate, the governor, and the House leadership will come together and come up with a real long-term road funding plan that doesn't harm local governments and public education.
Ken, you said you weren't crazy about the idea of looking into selling state assets like the Blue Water Bridge. What else did you see in the House budget that caused concern?
Well, there are some significant cuts, for example, I think Vicky mentioned it, to information technology, pretty severe, about $200 million, 25% across the board, which, you know, I don't think you could argue that that's a good idea in this day and age, because it sounds like, well, it's just sort of computers, but it's not. It's related to how you serve citizens around the state. But once again, this budget is just kind of an opening proposal. I think the House Republicans are staking their ground in road funding, that they want all the taxes paid at the pump to go to transportation. They have to figure out how to backfill these cuts to schools and revenue sharing. You can't just, you know, cut these programs and schools and revenue sharing without making up that money. But I see this as kind of an opening proposal.
Do you see a veto in the future if not much changes with the Senate?
Well, certainly. I mean, the governor has already made it very clear that she's not going to sign a budget that doesn't solve the road funding problem. But they know that. I mean, when I say they, I mean the Speaker and the Majority Leader in the Senate, both Republicans, they understand that. They're just kind of putting their opening proposals on the table so they can start serious negotiations.
Ken Sikkema is Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican Majority Leader in the Michigan Senate. Vicki Barnett is former Mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic member of the Michigan House, and you can hear them on most Fridays right here on Stateside. Thanks to both of you. Hopefully now that summer is officially here, you can start enjoying some summer-like weather.
We can only hope. Thanks, Lester.
Hey, thanks, Lester.
That is Stateside for today, directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock, who's been singing the tune of the March of the Gladiators, you know, the circus song. I think it has to do with his second job. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.